45 and 9:45 here on AM 580. Over the course of the hour, we'll discuss the sports writing process, how to develop an effective commentary, and we'll touch on some of the major goings-on in the sports world these days, including that guy who plays first base for the Cardinals. As we get rolling here, we welcome your questions and comments. Our phone number's 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. And Frank DeFord, we welcome you to the Afternoon Magazine.
Nice to be with you, Craig.
Glad to have you with us. First of all, I suspect a majority of our listeners know you more probably for your weekly morning edition commentaries than for anything else. I was wondering if maybe we could begin by talking about how you come up with an idea each week for a commentary and how you flesh out that idea.
It can sometimes be desperate because let me start this way. Mm-hmm. I've got 52 of them to do a year. And so I'm trying as much as possible to have a certain kind of variety. I mean, I always keep that in mind because sometimes I come up with ideas and I say, no, I had something pretty close to that 3 weeks ago. So I try to do a certain number of sort of humorous ones, a certain number of instructive ones, a certain number in which I may be in high dudgeon and taking some position one way or another. So I do try to vary them. And I keep that in the back of my mind at all times. I try to be, in most cases, I try to be current or to play off something that's current to talk about a larger situation. And then I try to throw in a few individuals. Like this week, I was with Ted Williams a couple of weeks ago in Florida. And so I'm doing the commentary on Ted Williams because it's his 80th birthday coming up. Mm-hmm. So as much as possible, I don't know if that made any sense because it isn't that clear a process. An awful lot of it is catch as catch can and serendipity. The hardest part, by the way, I think, is coming up with the idea.
Once you do come up with that idea, how do you then flesh it out into a sort of coherent, effective argument?
That's just a question of sitting down, thinking what I want to say, maybe going and doing some research on it, looking up quotes that are apropos to it, just sort of building a case, particularly if I am trying to make a point. Sometimes I sort of save up for it. For example, I remember a couple of months ago I did a commentary on why they ought to use more video in officiating games. And I had saved up for the last few months every time I'd seen, or actually a few years, every time I'd seen an example of a badly officiated game that could have been corrected if they just had used videotape. I kept it in a folder.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it's a question of just reaching back into a spotty but nonetheless voluminous memory bank. You just fall back on all those things. You know, Red Smith said once about writing a column, and a newspaper column is a little bit different than a radio commentary, but they're fairly much the same. He said it's easy. You just sit there before the typewriter until the little beads of blood appear on your forehead. And sometimes I feel that way. The advantage of radio over print is that you can be a little bit more informal. You can let your voice carry you a little bit more than when it's just the words on the page. And sometimes I fall back on that, histrionics.
How did you get into sports writing?
Drifted in. It was not something that I intended to do, but when I got out of college and I wanted to come to New York and I wanted to get into writing of some form or another, and I've always sort of moved back and forth a little bit between fiction and journalism, and the best offer I got was at Sports Illustrated. And Sports Illustrated has always been a beautifully written magazine. You know, even though the subject matter may not be the most important in the world, the writing has tended to be very, very good, and it was then. And so I thought, well, I'll go there for a few years and sort of hone my craft. But I just sort of never left. It was like the man who came to dinner.
Why make a career, though, out of watching people play games?
Well, that's a very good question. Jim Murray, the LA Times columnist who died just the other day, who probably was the best columnist of sports columnist of his generation and won the Pulitzer, talked about that often, about how foolish he felt on the one hand. And yet, on the other, sports is important to our society and to all cultures. It does have a place, and it lends itself to good writing. It really does. I mean, after all, you've got winners and losers every day. It's not like trying to explain the balance of payments, is it? And many of the people in sports are colorful and outspoken. I mean, this is why basically I stayed in it. And so I think that because it does present such a clean canvas to write on and a fresh canvas every day, I think that a lot of people who are more serious than you might imagine have stayed in sports for that reason, as a means to an end. It's no doubt, though, that you do sit around and question, why did I do this? There's important things going on in the world. You know, I was at the Stanley Cup when the Berlin Wall fell. I was at the Kentucky Derby when the civil rights marches were taking place. So you can make yourself feel very guilty. And so I think that I've always taken the approach that, it's not so much the material that you're covering, it's how well you cover it. And you can take that to extremes, and you can end up as a pornographer and justify that rationale. But nonetheless, in broad terms, that's been my excuse. I just would say in passing that one of the best reporters in America, a guy who covers his subject better than anybody else, is a guy named Dave Meltzer, and he writes about professional wrestling. But man, does he know it. Does he bring a lot to the table? And so I just throw that out as an example.
You mentioned Jim Murray and Dave Meltzer. Are there other writers that have inspired you as you've developed your craft?
I think that that there are a number of good writers. There probably, as a matter of fact, more good writers now in sports than there ever were before. There were always some very good ones, but there were a lot of hacks. And there still are some hacks in sports writing. But as a general cohort, we're a whole lot better than we ever used to be. I never wanted to be a columnist, which has always been sort of the Everest for most sports writers. I don't think I could have been a daily writer that way. I always wanted to write long stories. It's what I do better, the long form. And when I got into that at Sports Illustrated, a lot of people had done it, but nobody had was well known for it. Most of the great sports writers, Jimmy Cannon, Red Smith, Grantland Rice, Jim Murray, who was already in his ascendancy then, were known for being columnists. And so I didn't have any model in that sense. There were a lot of good sports stories that had been written that I could look to, but nobody had really created a body of work as primarily a long-form sports writer. In a way, I kind of figured out what I wanted and went out and did it on my own.
Are there subjects or elements of the sports world that you simply won't touch? Is there anything relating to sport, though? Is it anything's up for grabs?
I think pretty much anything is up for grabs. Yeah, I wouldn't shy away from anything. I know that there are things that I would rather do. People usually ask me quite the opposite, to say, what's your favorite sport? And you went 180 degrees the other way, so I'm not used to that.
Sorry.
I imagine there would be something that would offend me terribly, and I say, no, I just absolutely won't do that. I can't think of it off the top of my head. What I like to write about simply are the people who are most interesting. I mean, it's very, very easy. It's not complicated. I And my answer when people say, what's your favorite sport? I say, well, it really doesn't matter. I'm not looking for to do something necessarily that I like, a sport that I like. I'll do auto racing if I have to, if there's a good story there. And I've done a couple good stories in auto racing, even though you couldn't make me, you couldn't tie me down and make me sit and watch, you know, one of those races. And I don't think you have to like all sports to be a sports writer. On the other hand, I think if you really didn't like sports, it wouldn't be very wise to stay in the business.
Our guest is Frank DeFord. He's a senior contributing writer for Sports Illustrated magazine and a weekly commentator for Morning Edition. His commentaries air Wednesdays at 7:45 and 9:45 on AM 580. And as we continue our discussion, we welcome your questions at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. And Frank, I do want to get into some specific sports and topics in a bit, but first let's take a phone call. Caller from Champaign on line one. Hi.
Frank, it's great to have you on our local show.
Thank you.
I think I know how you feel about the sport of boxing, eh?
Yeah.
But, you know, I just finished reading a collection of essays, I guess, by Liebling on the sport. And, you know, I mean, he was doing that kind of long-form sort of thing, I guess, for the New Yorker, I think.
I guess he was. He wrote a lot of... He wasn't just in sports, though.
No, I know me.
He wrote a weekly column called The Wayward Press. Or not a weekly column, but he wrote probably more about journalism. And you're right, he did write about boxing.
Yeah.
Absolutely true, and that's a good point to mention.
I mean, but, you know, I don't know how seriously he takes it even, though, you know, because it's so facile, you know, his writing.
Well, boxing has always attracted writers, storytellers, because it's so simple. It's, you know, two guys getting in the ring and trying to...
Yep.
To pummel each other. It's primeval. I think as a general rule, the best sports to write about are those that involve the least people. In other words, to look at it from the other point of view, football is the worst sport to write about.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you know, there's more coaches than there are players in most sports, and it's sort of hard to focus on who the heroes and who the villains are, or the goats. And that's what makes boxing so wonderful. And also, it's true that even though I'm not crazy about boxing, some of the best people I've ever met are boxers. And when I remember when I was putting together a collection of my stories, which was called The World's Tallest Midget, you know, making sort of fun of myself as a sports writer, the story that I had to pick one story to lead off with, and I picked the boxing story.
Yep.
So I'm as guilty of that as all the other writers.
Well, good to have on your show.
Thank you.
Thanks for the phone call. Are there specific athletes or even specific sports or games or anything like that that you find personally inspiring?
Well, I think that any time you see a magnificent athletic performance, that inspires me. And it doesn't necessarily mean somebody has to win. Sometimes, as a matter of fact, the most gallant performances are in defeat. Most of the great athletes who have triumphed have needed some foil to get them to the top. I mean, the classic case being Muhammad Ali, that he had Joe Frazier. And if he had not had Joe Frazier to beat in those magnificent fights, he wouldn't be as highly regarded as he is. And that's true throughout history, that if you just win every game in a very easy fashion, you're not as courted as much attention as if you had to fight for those victories. And so I am absolutely inspired, and I'm not at the least bit ashamed to say that. And I think that if a great sporting contest does not thrill you in some way and inspire you, there's something wrong with you. I mean, by the same token, I can also be inspired by seeing a magnificent play or standing and looking before a wonderful painting. I think it's the same senses that come to work there. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why sport is increasingly more important in this culture, because more people are attracted to it, more people are aware of it and touched by it.
I remember a commentary that you did a couple of years ago comparing Cal Ripken to Mario Lemieux that really struck me in terms of how different these two individuals were and how their careers were, and yet how they both obviously inspire people.
Ripken, because he never gets hurt and he's there every day. And Lemieux, because this guy had not only a dreadful back, which finally forced him out, but he had to overcome cancer in the middle of his career. So those are, by the way, you asked earlier about commentaries. When I can piece two things together like that, I loved it. You can't do it very often. I think it becomes forced. But when you can grab two different people or two different teams from totally disparate parts of the sporting universe and bring them together, then I think you have improved your work.
We're talking with Frank DeFord, and if you would like to call in with a question or comment, the phone number is 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. And I suppose we might as well get down to the nitty-gritty here. And first of all, let's talk about, baseball. And there's some sort of chase for some record or something.
It's the most important, indisputably.
Why are we, the Maguire-Sosa home run chase, are we so enamored with this record?
Because, first of all, it was Babe Ruth who said it. There's only been one Babe Ruth in this century. I mean, here we were last week remembering very clearly and celebrating the fact that it was 50 years ago that he died. That's an anniversary I don't think that any other athlete it calls to attention. People don't say so-and-so died 25 years ago or 75 years ago. And 2 or 3 years ago, we were celebrating his centennial. And Ruth is just larger than life. So sort of anything connected with him. In fact, I did a commentary earlier this year and said he was the athlete of the year. There's been two television specials on him. The Yankees and their success have brought back memories of the 27 Yankees, which was the greatest team, and then Maguire and Sosa and Griffey and all the other home run hitters have made us remember Ruth. So that's a large part of it. This is Babe Ruth's record, even if he hasn't held it since 1961. I think we all love power. And Craig, it's such a simple record. I mean, it's not involved with dividing number at bats by the number of hits or some complicated formula or average points per game. It's you hit a home run, that's one. You hit two home runs, that's two. And it's just so simple and stark that I think we're all attracted to it.
With all due respect to fans in Chicago and Sammy Sosa, who's having a tremendous season, no question.
Yep.
I do want to talk a little bit about Mark Maguire, because something very different and odd has happened this year. He's sort of individually become the ambassador of the game. In particular, I just noticed, this last series the Cardinals just played with the Pittsburgh Pirates, they set a record in attendance in Pittsburgh with two consecutive sellouts. It's the first time in the history of Three Rivers. And my question to you is, this man's been hitting home runs for a lot of years now. Why now?
Well, it has sort of all come together here. He's moved to a different league, which he did a year ago. And home runs have traditionally been more connected with the American League than with they have with the National. I think also that this didn't catch us by surprise this year. The Maguire thing has been building. This is the third year in a row. He's the first person to hit 50 home runs or more in three successive years. And so his aura precedes him. I think also he's a very popular character. And again, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but he's Ruthian. And one of the reasons that a lot of people didn't accept Roger Maris was because he just didn't seem to be the right guy. He was miscast. And it was the feature. It was Ben Stiller playing the leading man. It doesn't work that way. And so Maguire just has sort of all the characteristics and also he just looks the part. And as you say, he's a tremendous ambassador. There's sort of no flies on him. They're trying to hang him with this drug thing right now for buying something over the counter. I think they're going to have a hard time draping anything really negative.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. We spoke about a month ago to Bill Littlefield about McGuire's use of creatine, and there are a lot of athletes that are clearly in favor of creatine, just as many who are opposed to it. And now with this report coming out of Mark McGuire using an over-the-counter, perfectly legal drug that Major League Baseball allows, do you think that there is, however, too much emphasis on performance-enhancing drugs in professional sports?
Well, I don't think there's any question. I mean, let me just say one thing. It's not like McGuire had been the 98-pound weakling 2 years ago. No. See, he hit 50 or 49 home runs as a rookie like 12 years ago, so he's always been there. And so this hasn't transformed him. I did a commentary about 2 or 3 weeks ago in which I played the devil's advocate, and I said maybe you just got to forget about drugs in sports, because the fact of the matter is that, and I'm talking about illegal drugs here, not the kind that McGuire uses, the fact of the matter is that it's so hard to detect them in so many cases that it almost becomes dumb luck if an athlete is caught. And it's getting harder and harder as the people who make the drugs and dispense them become more and more sophisticated. And I said, maybe, and I really was taking the contrarian point of view here, maybe you should look at it, well, what's really the difference whether you use drugs that enhances performance or a new kind of metal golf club that lets you hit it further or a new pair of shoes that lets you run faster? What's the difference? Now, I was being somewhat facetious when I said that, but I think it's going to be an issue that's going to dog us for much of the first part of the 21st century, and I don't know if anybody's ever going to figure it out.
We were speaking of the Yankees a few minutes ago, and wanted to come back to that team because obviously they're having a pretty good season.
Yeah, they're amazing.
Yeah, that may be the all-time best regular season record by the time they finished.
It was the Chicago team that they'd beat, you know.
Well, now, be careful.
The hitless Well, that's interesting because the hitless wonders, they were called. No, the White Sox were called the hitless wonders, and they beat the Cubs, and I think it was the 1906 World Series. And the Cubs had been the team that had won 122 games, I think.
I think that's right.
Tinker to Evers to Chance. Mm-hmm. But it just shows you, I mean, this is what the Yankees are so fearful of right now, that no matter how many games they win, if they don't win the World Series, then who cares? And it's possible.
Does that seem odd to you that this team that is having such great success, that there's so much emphasis now on the playoffs and there are so many teams now that their entire strategy, all you hear from coaches are, well, just wait till the playoffs.
Wait till the playoffs.
Yeah.
No, I'm afraid that that's just the reality. What makes baseball so different, though, is that if you had a comparable basketball or football or hockey team that won all these games, the chances of it being upset would be very remote. But baseball's so unusual and altogether unique in that because you've got a different pitcher each game, it changes everything dramatically. And if, for example, a basketball team like the one you have there in Chicago, we knew pretty much what it was going to do every game, didn't we? I mean, it would vary a little bit. One night, Michael would get 33 points, and one night he'd get 29. And one night, Kukoc would get 16, and Pippen would get 18. And the next night, it would be Pippen 20 and Kukoc 12. But, I mean, there weren't a whole lot of changes from day to day. But that's not true in baseball. You can get David Cone to pitch a three-hitter and get beat 1-0. And the next day, Andy Pettit could come out and win 8-7 or get beat 8-7, and all of a sudden you're down 2-0. And it can happen. And so that's why baseball is so very, very different from all the other sports, and why the teams that haven't done as well can point to the playoffs.
You mentioned the Bulls. Might as well talk a little bit about basketball.
Sure.
Well, basically, yeah.
I guess the answer is, one question
is, what's the problem?
I don't know.
I mean, the players are raking it in. The owners are swimming in money. You know,
right?
Play ball.
But didn't we say this about baseball?
Yes.
Didn't we say this about football? Everybody just wants more. And so far, the answer has been at the conclusion of these strikes, even if it's taken a few years to get back to where we were, everybody's made more in the long run. And so nobody's been punished for strikes, really. An individual players, maybe a team here and there. But by and large, the sports have climbed out of the hole and gone ahead magnificently. And so there really isn't been any punishment to fit the crime so far. And the only people who really get punished are you and me, the fans, because they just raise the ticket prices and pay for the strike that way. We're having a phone strike here in Connecticut right now, and I guarantee you, when the strike's over, they're not going to raise the prices of a phone call by 50% and settle things that way, because the people wouldn't take it. But they do in sports.
Of course, in the baseball strike in 94, you could perhaps make the argument that really that sport did not come back until something specific, a remarkable event. In this
case,
Cal Ripken's consecutive game streak, and now with McGuire, now maybe the sport is back, but it required that sort of event, that real specific draw and reason.
People say, fans, which those kind of people, fans say, I'm so furious at both of them, I'm never going to go see another game, right? But slowly they work their way back. they fall off the wagon. And it happens every time that people swear that this will be the last time, that they will not put up with this kind of thing. They all scream a plague on both of your houses and so forth. But the reality is, when we look back, that eventually they put their tails between their legs and come back and buy the tickets. And as long as that's been the case, then sports can suffer these kind of strikes. I have no way of knowing right now, and I'm not so sure anybody does, what's going to happen insofar as basketball is concerned. They really haven't even started talking until the last couple of days. So what lies ahead is really unknown, uncharted territory.
Do you suspect that it's a similar situation to elective government, where you look at, say, people in Congress and you say, oh, they're all bums except for my guy?
That's right. Absolutely. You know, Craig, it's fascinating you say that, because people always say, these players are paid entirely too much. And then the minute that one guy on their team wants to leave, everybody says, what's the matter with that cheap owner of ours? Pay him. Keep him. There's no question. That's exactly the analogy.
We're talking with Frank DeFord, and if you have any questions or comments, our phone number is 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. If you have any questions or comments about sports writing, sports commentaries, or about specific sports or games or teams or players, give us a call. Again, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Well, we are now coming to the end of preseason football. Do you have any early thoughts on teams that might be strong out of the gate or any franchises?
I try not to think about football until around Thanksgiving time. I'm being a little cynical when I say that, but I think at this time of the year you leave it to the experts in the various sports, who are invariably are wrong, by the way. They seldom get it right. Nobody even thought the Yankees... I mean, very few people thought the Yankees were going to win their division this year, much less be the greatest team in history. And I think I'll stick to trying to get the Powerball as opposed to trying to guess what the best teams are.
Fair enough.
But I would say this: I find it interesting that the Cowboys, who have meant so much to pro football, obviously have not righted the ship. And I'll be curious if another team will kind of start to emerge as America's team. Because the Cowboys have always been something special for a long, long time. and other teams would come along, like the 49ers in particular, and the Dolphins and so forth, and they would have their moment in the sun and then kind of fade away. But the decline of the Cowboys I find terribly, terribly interesting. And I don't think they're going to be back for quite a while. It's very much harder to turn a football team around simply because of the huge amount of the Mongol hordes who play for them than, you know, a basketball team or a hockey team or even a baseball team.
Yeah, they're America's team, unless you're like me and you grew up in St. Louis and you had only one possibility of looking at the season as a positive season, and that's if the football Cardinals were able to beat Dallas once.
Well, see, that's just it. You either – they were America's team one way or the other. Now, maybe you hated America's team, or maybe you loved America's team, but you had an opinion on America's team.
Certainly true.
And that's what the one thing I think that the NFL is going to lack now, that kind of coalescing – element. And there's so many teams in football now that didn't used to be, and I think it's awfully hard for the average fan to sort of keep it straight. All sports have that problem now.
Let's take a call. We have a caller on line one on the U of I campus. Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Just wanted to comment to Frank that I enjoyed reading his columns or his articles over the years and listening to him on the radio. I was glad he explained his statement about drugs. I thought he had an interesting statement there, and I was wondering if it wasn't a bit tongue-in-cheek. What I wanted to ask is, in the last 10 years, what would you consider your most intriguing sports story? I'll just hang up and listen. Thanks a lot, and enjoyed your talk.
Thanks for the call.
The last 10 years, my most intriguing sports story. Oh, boy. Nothing, you know, I feel sort of silly because nothing pops into my mind right now that would satisfy that. I don't think I've had any intriguing. I've had stories that I liked. I did one not long ago, which I liked a lot because it was about a guy named Howard Bingham who has been Muhammad Ali's best friend through the years, and everybody else has left Muhammad Ali. And Howard has stayed with him. He's a photographer. And maybe that's intriguing, and it's certainly fresh in my mind because it's kind of something off-center, and that's what I prefer to look for. Another story I liked a lot, because she came through for me too, is Peekaboo Street when she won the Olympics last year. And I found her to be one of the most intriguing and fascinating young women that I had ever come across. I don't think I quite answered that question, but that's the best I can do.
Well, that's a tough one, though.
Yeah, unless something hits your mind, and that's what you're always. By the way, that's what you're always looking for. That's the hardest thing about sports writing right now. And when I got into the business, it was much easier to find intriguing story. But now, when you've got kids who are 13 or 14 years old and already they're getting a national press, it becomes very hard to sort of turn over rocks and find new stories. Very difficult indeed. I think that there's a sameness to sports writing now which threatens its quality to some extent.
Well, how about the story of the year for golf?
Well, I guess you'd have to say it's O'Meara. Winning the two championships, two of the four majors, but I think that in a way you could almost make the case that it's Tiger Woods not winning any and coming very close. I mean, people say, "What's the matter with Tiger Woods?" But it's like what's the matter with Ken Griffey? He's only got 44 home runs, I think there's also an interesting story in what appears to be, and I'm not that much of a golf authority, though I've got a essay coming out in Sports Illustrated on golf, a humorous essay, and a poll we've taken, which proves that golfers are different from other people. I don't mean professional golfers. I mean weekend golfers. They're different from other people. But there appear to be more and more Asians playing golf, and I think that's very intriguing, that this seems to be some kind of a wave that's coming in. Golf is becoming more international than it ever was before. It was always an international game, but it was really sort of located in just a few countries. And I think golf is opening up quite a bit now. And, of course, Tiger Woods is all by himself a little United Nations.
I have a quick weather update to throw out. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of northern Indiana, as well as southwestern Michigan and southern Lake Michigan. And there are some counties in the AM 580 severe weather coverage area included in this watch. They are Benton, Tippecanoe, and Warren counties in Indiana. And that's in effect until 7 o'clock tonight. Again, that's a severe thunderstorm watch for Benton, Tippecanoe, and Warren counties in Indiana, beginning from 2 o'clock until 7 o'clock tonight. So we will keep you apprised of the weather situation. Be sure to stay tuned to AM 580. And let's move on to another caller, line 4, from Elliot. Good afternoon.
I thought you would be interested to know that this past summer, the University of Illinois football coach, Ron Turner, was on an airline trip, and he met Peekaboo Street.
Mm-hmm.
And they became acquainted and talked. And I believe that she is coming to the university to sing the national anthem at one of the home football games.
Peekaboo is?
Yes.
I didn't know she could sing. It doesn't surprise me. She can do just about anything that she puts her mind to.
Yes. Well, apparently this was intriguing to Coach Turner, and so she was interested in doing that. So I haven't heard any more about it, but I'm hoping that we have season tickets, so we're looking forward to that.
Well, she's an engaging young woman.
Yes, I've always been interested in following her. I guess her name was what intrigued me the very first time I heard of her and how she got her name.
She's lived up to it.
Yes, she certainly has.
She has. Well, that's fascinating, and I'm not the least bit surprised because she'd try anything. You know, she got injured.
Yes,
and,
sorry to hear that.
So I guess she's looking for other things to do, but Peekaboo will, I'm sure, always be able to stay in the spotlight because
right.
she is so attractive.
Right. I enjoy listening to you.
Thank you very much.
WILL.
All right. Well, thanks for the phone call. Before we run out of time, we still have a few minutes left and time for more calls at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. But I want to talk about my personal favorite subject, hockey. So there's a new deal, a television deal for the National Hockey League with ABC and ESPN, and Fox has said no more. And the good news, in my opinion, is it's the end of the glowing puck. Beyond that, do you think this indicates any sort of rise for that league?
Well, I think everybody was totally flabbergasted at the amount of money that ESPN put on the table. It was like five times the past figure.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, hockey has had terrible ratings. That's been a large part of the failure of the sport to really grow. And to catch up with the big three has been the fact that it doesn't televise nearly as well as most other games because you just can't follow the puck that well, and particularly can't follow it when it goes into the net. And I don't know how anybody's ever going to overcome that because the beauty of the game is that it is so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And you miss a lot even when you're there at an arena, but then the game itself and what's going on the rink, even if you can't see the puck altogether, it carries you along and you get so wrapped up in it. And I think that the trick is going to be to somehow figure out how to make it easier for people on television to follow that puck. And if anybody can ever do that, it's going to be the better mousetrap. It really is. I think hockey is always going to be a very solid sport in terms of its popularity. I think it's going to expand some in popularity now that women are playing it. And, of course, our team won the Olympics last year, our women's team. I think that hockey would do better if it got rid of some of the violence and incorporated some of the smoother, more beautiful moves that are emphasized more in the European game. Everybody always says the same thing about hockey. If there are 20,000 seats in Chicago in the United Arena, people say, well, there's only 20,000 fans, hockey fans. That's mm-hmm. always the gag, that it's passionate but a small core. And it somehow has to figure out a way to move beyond that core. But certainly with ESPN in its pocket, with all that money, it's a great step in the right direction.
Well, that was certainly the case in St. Louis until someone named Brett Hull came along and all of a sudden sold out arenas, and it became an extremely popular sport there, and now the franchise is moving on without him.
Yeah.
And very interesting. It seems that sometimes it takes an individual player to bring up that popularity of a particular sport, but you don't necessarily need that player down the road to continue it. Because
he gets you into the tent.
Right.
And then you say, gee, I like this. And that's really necessary in hockey, where, say, it doesn't televise that well. Since so many other sports, you see them and say, gee, I like that. I'm going to go out there. And you miss so much watching hockey on television. And the other problem it's had, and you just mentioned it, Craig, I mean, you talked about Brett Hull, there aren't that many big names. I mean, most people, if you said name a hockey player, they'd say Wayne Gretzky. And
maybe
he's right at the end of his career.
Yeah.
And the sport has not developed the kind of superstars that that basketball in particular has, and that's very important because the two sports are up against each other in terms of the calendar.
I do want to touch on tennis. That's one sport we haven't gotten to yet. As far as pro tennis is concerned, on the men's side, I guess we would say at this point that Pete Sampras is the guy.
He's the guy, but Pete's a great guy off the field, off the court. He doesn't light any fires on the court. And he's the best, but he seems to be in some slump. He won Wimbledon, but, of course, that's the only tournament that's played on grass, the only substantive tournament that's played on grass. It's been a long time since he had a really good tournament that wasn't on grass. And so there's some people who think that he's struggling. He's one short of 12 Grand Slams, which is the record held by Roy Emerson. And he seems to be stalled there except for Wimbledon. It may be it's this burnout factor in tennis, which just about by the time you're 26, which is what Pete is now, you're finished in tennis, whereas you're just sort of getting started in most sports at the age of 26. And the women seem to burn out even faster, because they start when they're about, you know, still in kindergarten.
Well, it's remarkable what Martina Hingis has done at her age already.
But she's already sort of over the hill. Most people, you know, sort of like, well, last year, well, that was really her peak when she was 16. And now, you know, at 17, she's okay, but look for Kornikova, who's 15. That's the way they talk. I mean, and I think that hurts. I think that hurts tennis because, all due respect to children, you know, they're what do they say? They're to be seen and not heard, and it's hard to sort of identify with 17-year-olds. They haven't had a whole lot of life experiences away from the net.
Well, Frank, I'm sorry to say we are plumb out of time. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and I hope we could do this again sometime.
I hope so, Craig. I've enjoyed it.
That's Frank DeFord, a senior contributing writer for Sports Illustrated magazine. He's also a weekly commentator on Morning Edition, and you can hear those commentaries every Wednesday at 7:45 and 9:45 here on AM 580.